Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host Alfred Addisk will join you after the first segment today, along with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. And today is Thursday, March 3rd, 2016. Once again, we had gold closing at a 13-month high today, so some good numbers for gold. Gold currently is up $2,290 at $1,263. Silver's up $29 at $1,532, along with platinum up $14 at $952. Palladium was also up 22 today, almost about a four and a quarter percent at $543. USDX today is trading, let's go to the USDX today, 0.60, little pressure, 97.53. You're going to hear reports, oh, the US dollar is much weaker, that's why gold, well, that's hardly anything even to speak of, 0.60 at 97.53 for gold to respond. So a good day for gold. A lot of buyers out there for gold and silver. Paper markets today, not a whole lot, although the Dow is creeping up to that 17,000 level, 16,943, up 44 points. The NASDAQ up 4 at 47.07, and the S&P also up 7 at 19.93. And European markets today, a little pressure, nothing to talk about, so to speak. 10-year yield, 1.83%, down 0.02. And the euro climbed with the weakness in the dollar, up 0.88 at 1.10. Before I get into what I want to get into, I got two things I'm going to talk about. A lot of this will probably will be a part two of next week. And first I want to talk about everyone is looking forward to the unemployment report tomorrow. And again, that's a big economic data point, you know, whether this will encourage Janet Yellen to increase the rates another 0.25%. They're expected to show a rise of around 200,000. But then again, we all know these numbers are padded, and Lord knows what they do in an election year. Maybe they're saving the big numbers as we get closer to the election this fall, but we'll see what that shows. So your market people, your investment planners and so forth are all eyeing that number. Also, China's supposed to come out. They're meeting on Saturday to talk about what they're going to do by their government officials. And we do have some information on that about the number of employees that China is aiming to lay off. So if you want to hear about some major layoffs, they're going to be laying off about 5 to 6 million state workers over the next 2 or 3 years, as they certainly have to curb industrial overcapacity and pollution. But first, before we go into that a little bit more, I wanted to talk about the Mint State 63 $10 Indian gold pieces. We had a nice little move in those today. It increased $25 this morning in just one day. In one day, they went up $25. Now, because they are a half ounce, or just about a half ounce, it takes two to get a big piece. So if you look at the melt value per ounce, you're looking at a move of $50 in this coin today. We were selling these coins just a little over a week ago, and at $870. Today's price, why do I hear music?
Pandemic.
Okay. So anyway, I will continue. Not sure what that was all about, but we're selling the same package, a Mint State 63 $10 Indian gold piece with a silver eagle, free silver eagle, for $950. So a great move in that package. Plus, silver is also gone up. So a nice little package for $950, a Mint State 63 $10 Indian gold piece. I told you they were way underpriced. They still are. That's a great move in one day for a Mint State 63 $10 Indian gold piece. And I viewed all my other $20 gold piece, some of my $10 gold pieces. This is the only coin that made a significant move today. So a lot of demand, and again, the supply is low. They're a great coin to add to your portfolio. 800-375-4188. Give us a call, but I don't want to waste time giving out my phone number. I want to talk about China, and certainly they have a lot of layoffs coming up. But what's interesting is they have things that are called zombie state firms. We know they have ghost cities. They build all these cities where no one lives, no one works, but they've just built them out. Got to keep building. When you're an economy that is all based on debt, you got to keep building, you got to keep growing, and this is what China's done. Now, because they have these layoffs, they have these things that are called zombie state firms. And the term refers to companies that have shut down some of their operations, but they keep staff on their roles, since local governments are worried about the social and economic impact of bankruptcies and unemployment. Now, this is one of China's big priorities this year and next year, is to start shutting these zombie firms down. But then again, if they're concerned now about bankruptcies and social and economic impact, once you start something, how do you cut it? Particularly when we're talking about an additional 5 to 6 million people. Now, that might not be a whole lot of people in China, considering the number of people that they do have, but I think that's a lot in any country. On Monday, the Minister for Human Resources and Social Security says China expected to lay off about 1.8 million workers in the coal and steel industries. He didn't give a time frame. This looks like this could be an additional 1.8 million workers to the 5 to 6 that was reported today, or it was actually reported yesterday. We didn't get a chance to talk about this during the program. So there's a huge debt overhang. And again, the pressures, we've seen the commodity market drop. They're looking to cut as much as 150 million tons of crude steel capacity and 500 million tons of surplus coal production in the next 3 to 5 years. So again, a lot of pressure on those governments. And what I'm going to talk about today is the debt. I'm going to talk about the world debt. And I'm going to talk about, You know, I don't believe this. I believe this is a system that is unwinding. It is a debt system. And it just wasn't created in 2008. It wasn't created with the stimulus or the quantitative easing. It wasn't in 2000 that we had this debt that was created. We're going to go back to 1987. Bloomberg. Matthew Phillips, he says, one of the loudest creaking sounds coming from the markets right now is the global economy straining under a record pile of debt. The world continues to borrow hand over fist since the financial crisis. And now he's talking about 2007, where he's adding nearly $60 trillion. The worldwide debt load, $200 trillion. Or nearly three times the size of the entire global economy. So those numbers only take us to 2014. So you can, you know, tack on who knows how many trillions of dollars. I read a report, a credit bubble bulletin, Doug Noland. And this is what I want to share with you. He did a report on this debt, world debt. The credit markets going back to 1987. I don't know if you've heard of him. I have. Maybe you heard him on a program or two. You can visit his website or sign up for our weekly newsletter. I'm going to do postings of his commentary. He kind of gives a report like John Williams from Shadow Stats, but he has a deeper understanding of the world credit markets, or at least he goes a little bit more into the world credit markets than John Williams. And he says, what we're experiencing today is the whole complete corrupt system that is beginning to unwind. We talk about this program all the time, about how this system, this debt system, was actually created once they created the fiat currency, once we got into that system. Without this fiat currency, there would be no global financial system to which it is operating. There's no limitations to the type of credit that is issued. There's no limitations to the quantity or the quality. And folks, this is what it's all about. This is what's going to bring down the markets, because all of these markets, you know, you look at the Dow, 17,000, you know, the NASDAQ is back, you know, all these world markets, and all of you who have financial retirement accounts, who pension funds, retirement accounts, your IRAs are all tied to these markets. All of these high numbers is just based all on debt. That's how they got these high numbers. And you couldn't have that without this debt, without this fiat system. You know, today Romney ended his speech about Donald Trump's plans. He says if they were ever implemented, the country would sink into a prolonged recession. Hello, we are already in a prolonged recession since 1987. You had credit bubbles that were established for the make-believe prosperity that we see, for the illusion that was created. And now we're just not talking about the U.S. We're talking about the whole world is experiencing this excess. And no one will or can address these imbalances. You, me, the people around the world, we're going to be robbed. Our livelihoods, our standard of living, which has already been affected, will all be destroyed for what you are accustomed to. There will be no way to recapture these losses. You have to protect yourself, and you know what you need to do. This information, this report, is truly one of the best timeline views of this credit bubble that I have read, and I have read many. The numbers will shock you, and we're going to, again, put this in our newsletter on Monday. So, you know, make sure you go to our website, dgscoins.com, get signed up for it so you can read the whole report. I know I only have 5 minutes left, and if I have to do a part two next Thursday, I will do so. But this is really interesting, and it is frightening when you look at these numbers. This article references this recent 7-year period of which a massive $12 trillion of global central bank money creation and market liquidity injections. He begins with the U.S. repudiation of the gold standard in 1971 as a very critical development. The 70s, you had the oil shock, stagflation, you had the Latin America debt debacle, all were instrumental in the beginning of this whole debt bubble. Alan Greenspan, the Fed's reaction to the 1987 stock market crash, was truly the defining genesis of today's global credit bubble. And, you know, earlier this week, we talked about Greenspan. It isn't because I admire the guy, but here's a guy who basically started this evolution of the world financial markets. Even though the changes started much earlier, he was in a place at a very critical time in 1987. When he talks about the system he helped to create, perhaps we should pay a little bit of attention when he's saying that he has no hope at all, or he's not positive about anything. So, no, I don't, you know, he's not a fan of mine. I don't admire the guy. You know, he's an elite, and whatever made him, you know, do what he did after he had a belief of gold, he still tells people to buy gold. Why he did what he did, he'll have to deal with it sooner or later. We heard Bernanke repeatedly tell markets after 2008 the Fed will remain accommodative when needed. And this was the same assurances that came out at the Fed back in 1987. These were the first bailout of the markets. You had declining bond yields by 87. This had helped spur this rapid expansion in corporate bonds. GSE securitizations, those are government-sponsored enterprise. This is backing by the U.S. government, corporate welfare, so to speak. You had commercial paper, securities financing, derivatives began trading. All of these new investment tools were created or substantially grown. And guess what? The Federal Reserve looked the other way as bubbles ballooned into junk bonds, leverage buyouts, and commercial and residential real estate. You know, you had debt securities surged $7 trillion. You might be saying, well, you know what, Melanie, that's old news. You know, it's 1987. What are you going to tell us about today? Well, today is all about 1987. It was 1987 where all this debt began to be created. It was when you had the stock market boom, when you had all these financial news programs begin to, that were created and produced that we've never seen before. And this is why. And this is what the numbers today in stock markets are all based on. It has to keep growing. But how much further can it grow? That is the importance. This is the urgency that I'm trying to get to you. When you see these numbers back in 1987, in the early 90s, when this was created, $7 trillion in debt securities, GSE securities surged 283%, corporate bonds jumped 254%. To $3 trillion. Outstanding asset-backed securities. They were over, 1,600%. I mean, these numbers aren't any different than what they're doing today. But this debt, that debt just continued to grow. And we see these numbers. Certainly worth noting, over this period, the global derivative markets expanded from an almost non-existent to about $64 trillion. Today, they're over, quadrillion. So, again, you have ETFs. They were nothing. Everything, all of these investment financial vehicles were just created out of thin air, basically. It was all created by debt, and the global bubble dynamics, I mean, it all started, and it hasn't changed. We're on this recession, and I just got started, just got started on this. Make sure you get to the website. Make sure you sign up. DGScoins.com. And, you know, even with the bailout, the long-term capital management is all in play there, and you'll be able to read it all from the website. Thank you for joining me, Al, and James will be here in just a few minutes.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. The report focuses on geopolitical issues around the world, and always a pleasure to have James on the program. I try to stump him with questions from time to time, and I haven't had much success at it. It's really remarkable. James seems to know something about almost everything geopolitical.
Seems is a good word.
Yeah, I understand that. I'll find a chink in the armor here one of these days. How are you doing, James?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm a little bit croaky today. My voice seems to be going a little bit, but I'm going to do my best.
All right, I'm going to start this. I'm tired of trying to find intelligent questions to ask you. I'm going to start with an odd question. All right, a couple of premises. I saw a video just in the last couple of days of robots, and it focused on half a dozen different robots, and at least two of them were in Japan, and it included Nao, NAO, and Asimov. the brands of two of the robots. You may have seen these. I don't know if you've seen them or not, if you recall seeing them, but they're really quite extraordinary. And it's clear that Japanese robot technology leads the world right now. We're not just talking about automation for machines. We're talking about little creatures, little machines, but they look like people. They have two arms, two legs, a head, and so on. And it's surprising how beguiling these little machines are. The second premise, Japanese demographics. Young Japanese aren't reproducing in sufficient numbers to sustain the Japanese society and nation, although that's according to some reports I've heard. You'd know better. And three, there's a certain amount of xenophobia in Japan, where Japanese have a reputation for allegedly disliking foreigners, except Canadians, of course, living in their country. Faced with a shortage of Japanese children, Japan is reportedly closing schools rather than to allow an influx of fertile foreigners who would presumably reproduce and sustain the Japanese economy. And finally, the questions. Are the Japanese building and perhaps even perfecting robots to compensate, at least in part, for the refusal of young Japanese to reproduce? Do some Japanese imagine that the robots might one day substitute for enough of their declining numbers of children to sustain their nation? Do you see what I'm saying there?
I do. I do see what you're saying. It is a bit of an odd question, but there is a logic to it. I would say this is not the reason or the primary reason that these robots are being worked on, but there is something to that, isn't there? And we've seen this in any number of stories of, for example, nursing care. They're trying to get more robotic nursing care here in the country because, of course, as people might know, it's an aging country. It is it's primarily elderly people at this point, and it's only going to get more and more elderly as the years go on. And there's going to be a shortage of nurses and people who can take care of elderly people. They're already talking about the idea of having, you know, healthcare robots that can fluff your pillow and give you a shot or something like that, something along those lines. So that's already an idea that is being talked about and they're explicitly working toward. And another idea that has been floated around is the idea of sex robots. Robots for the purposes of, I guess, people who don't have boyfriends or girlfriends. Well, here's your robot lover. That is at least an idea that's been talked about. I don't know how serious that is at this point, but I suppose one can imagine, you know, take this technology forward a few generations and who knows at that point. So I think there is, I mean, we as a society, as a species on this planet, I think we're going to have to start really thinking about these issues in a deeper way than we have before, because there is something to it, the idea that we are kind of building our replacements instead of making our replacements.
Yeah, it's strange stuff. I read a book by a man named Robert Ardrey back in the 1960s. It was called African Genesis, and it talked about mankind's rise coming out of Africa, it supported evolution and so on. But he made the argument that the focus of human culture is not tool-making. You know, we say, oh, man, the tool-making animal. He said, no. If you want to understand mankind, you have to recognize man as the weapon-making animal. All right? That was his perspective on this. And it just comes to mind when you talk about they're building robots and they're going to have sex robots. Well, it might be correct. Ardrey's argument that we are the weapons-making animal, maybe it's incomplete. Maybe it should be we are the weapons-making and sexually obsessed animal. And those would be the two focuses of civilization. And
there is truth to that. I think, well, tools, I mean, weapons are an extension of the subset of tools, I would say, or are a subset of tools. So I think they do go hand in hand. And, of course, you just think back to the opening scenes of 2001 with the apes discovering tools and then immediately using them to beat each other to death. And I think there is probably some sort of, you know, kernel of truth in that imagery as well. So I think that's right. And that opens up the more pertinent discussion here, rather than, you know, healthcare robots or sex robots, is weaponized robots.
Yep.
And I don't think it takes a lot of imagination to see how these could become the perfect soldiers in the very near future, a lot nearer than people think. And you talk about the Japanese leading the way. The most interesting robot that I've seen and has went somewhat viral on the internet in the last week or two is from Boston Dynamics, owned now by Google, or Google's parent company, Alphabet Inc., that is, I mean, you have to see it to fathom it. It really looks quite lifelike at this point in terms of the way that it moves, the way that it can be knocked over and stand back up, the way that it can lift and carry objects around and find objects and pick them up and things like this. I mean, it is really happening now, and it is accelerating. I think at this point we understand that the technological improvements are accelerating. They're on an exponential curve. So it does not take much imagination to see within a decade or two how these could really be the perfect killers. And that is, I mean, that's the scariest part of all of this.
One of the strangest things I saw when I watched the videos on the robots that were manlike, right? They looked like people. You know, they have some of them that even have faces that are very close to being, you know, that of people. But most of the robots that you could see, if you look, these were still machines. And yet, when you see some of these machines, that they try to knock them over, right? And as you were just mentioning, and the machine is going to pick up this box, and somebody's up there standing there next to the box with a hockey stick, and he keeps shoving the box out of the machine's reach. And the machine crouches down to pick up the box. And then this guy pushes the box out of the robot's reach, and the robot stands up again. Then it walks up closer to pick up the box, and he pushes the box out of the way again. And the robot walks up again to push. And you wind up feeling a certain amount of sympathy for the robot. You sit there and say, why didn't that robot smack that guy that keeps pushing the box out of the way? And it's,
yeah.
I don't know if you felt a similar response.
Yeah, no, I think, and I think that was well reflected in the comments for that video. Everyone was talking about, you know, either expressing some sort of sympathy or saying, you know, when the robot takeover happens, this guy's going to get it first.
Kind of thing.
People rooting for the robot in a way.
Yeah.
Because as humans, of course, we are hardwired to see something human-like and to have some sort of empathy for it, which is, of course, something the robots won't have in return. So that is perhaps a disadvantage for us in, you know, the coming robot holocaust of the future. It all sounds like crazy sci-fi stuff, but if people haven't seen it, I suggest they check out the video because, there's no other way to think about it. And yes, you're referring to the video that did go viral. It's Boston Dynamics' latest.
And I saw at least one of the versions of that robot, they had it dressed up in fatigues.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It wasn't just a plastic exoskin on it that, you know, like the Now and Asimov. It was dressed up in fatigues and the way it
and,
moved and whatever.
Let's tie it all up together.
Like a living man.
Well, let's tie it all up with a bow, because as I said, Boston Dynamics owned by Google's parent company. And guess who was just appointed to the new Pentagon Innovation Advisory Board, advising the Pentagon on how to, you know, innovate with new technology? Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google. It's literally the merging of the tech state and the military state, if there was ever really a difference. I mean, if you look into the history of Silicon Valley, it was seeded by the government, the military, and the intelligence agencies. A lot of that's where the technology came from. That's where a lot of the people involved in this technology came from. And now they're getting, you know, absorbed back into the Pentagon quite openly. It's, I mean, that's
who's absorbing
that's a very
who? Who is absorbing who? As are the military absorbing the technology, or is the technology absorbing the military?
Hmm.
It raises interesting questions, and these aren't original questions. You've seen them in science fiction movies. Who's really running this show? And it's very strange, and it was a little unnerving when I watched it to see that I had sympathy for this machine. That was amazing to me. I wouldn't have thought that I was susceptible to that.
Exactly right. But let's celebrate that. That is humanity's better instincts. It means you're not a psychopath, that you have human empathy and emotion. That is something that is a strength of humanity. But of course it can be used against us when social engineers want to make something cute and cuddly so that we'll accept it. Unfortunately, we are hardwired more often than not to do so. And it's the same reason why you cry at a movie where there's a cute cartoon character that gets hurt or whatever. I mean, it's the exact same thing. And it's both a strength and a weakness of humanity, I guess, but it's humanity.
Well, I'll tell you, it's educational. Whatever gets me, it won't be boredom. There is something new happening every day. You've seen reports that the world was unchanging during the Middle Ages. People would live in one little hamlet community. They stayed there all their lives. Technology didn't change dramatically. What you knew the same thing your grandparents knew in terms of what you had to know to get by in your community to do your job. There was a stability there. Nowadays, where do you find anything that you can just suspect, oh, that'll be the same, whatever we're looking at here right now, that'll be the same even a week from now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything's moving.
I was just reflecting on that the other day, trying to imagine a society that had been the same for generations. And mm-hmm. It was difficult for me to do so because, of course, that's not the world we're growing up in. Okay. And it's interesting to me from the perspective of someone who has looked at a lot of these social engineers of various sorts who have written in the past about how they want to try to engineer society this way or that way by, with this technology or what have you. But even from their perspective, I think this is really a sort of uncontrolled experiment with humanity itself, because no one really knows when you wrench humans into this ever-evolving, extremely fast-paced, changing world. On a global scale, I mean, how are people going to react? No one really knows that for sure, but we're starting to see, some of the reactions that people are having to this. And I think that's reflected in a lot of things, and it's difficult to tear that apart from all of the other things that they're reacting to, the economic dislocations or the military aggressions or those types of things. But it's all part and parcel. And I think we're starting to see that in the way, for example, the American political culture is tearing itself apart at the seams. I mean, there's some really strange things happening right now.
How will people keep up? Because the reality is this. We are being stressed by technology. It used to be we thought, oh, isn't this cool? I got a new ice maker for the refrigerator. Isn't that cool? Technology was clearly our servant, or at least it seemed to be clear. Right now, it is our competitor in a sense that how do you keep up with all of this? And there's a percentage of the population that absolutely can't keep up. They don't have enough intelligence to do so. They're going to be left behind, and what's going to happen to them?
I think the short answer is that the logic of the situation dictates that we will eventually have to start incorporating the technology in order to keep up with the technology. That's the idea of transhumanism. We have to start enhancing ourselves with various technologies. And that could be the brain chip or whatever they come up with, or it could be genetic manipulation, those types of things. I mean, that's what we're looking at ultimately, is that how are you going to keep up with all of this? Well, you're going to have to start incorporating this technology. And if you don't, you're going to be left in the dust. You're going to be in the dustbin of history, and you'll be an old fuddy-duddy that, won't know what's happening and won't be able to keep up. And I don't know what the answer to that is, really, because
I don't think anyone can.
Innovation is going to stop, I mean, I don't think you can put that cork on the bottle at this point.
I agree. So what you're saying is if you can't beat them, join them.
Well, I'm not saying that. Well, just to be clear, I'm not saying that. But I think that is certainly there are transhumanists who are arguing that already. And I think there will be a lot more of them in the future.
All right, let's take a break for some commercial announcements. And I'll be back with James Corbett on financial survival in about 2.5 minutes. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Job stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival, and our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James, like 2 weeks ago, it seemed that Syria and the Middle East were on the verge of World War III. But over the last week, the news media have been fairly silent about Syria. Have cooler heads prevailed? Have the threats of invasion by Syria, of invasion of Syria by Turkey, and Saudi Arabia been quenched? Is World War III less likely? And if so, how long will this respite last?
To be honest, I'm not sure there is a respite, or at least not much of one. I think perhaps the American news media has just turned its attention to the primaries. But there are still developments going on. And the latest is that, for example, Fox is reporting Russian bombing ahead of peace talks prepares for future fighting. So, again, there's still bombing going on. There's still mudslinging going on, perhaps not at the scale that it was recently, but still happening. And now Israel is also saying that Syria used chemical weapons during the ceasefire. So, again, I think it's still very much a tinderbox. But they're trying to put out hope that there's some sort of peace process underway right now. But I'll put as much faith in that peace process as I have at any time in this entire predicament. Let me ask you: can you imagine a scenario to end this conflict that will not put egg on someone's face? Because that's the only way this conflict is going to end, and I do not see that right now.
Part of the problem is you have. Who is really in charge in Syria? You know, if you have a war between the Allies and the Axis powers, you got an idea who the leaders are and who you got to talk to if you want to stop the war, call a truce, or whatever. There are so many players in Syria right now that I don't think any one person can claim to be one nation, one coalition. Can anyone claim to be in control, including Syria?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say that the Syrian government has the best claim to control, not just in a theoretical or moral sense or anything, but in actuality. I think the Syrian government has been on the ascendant in this struggle for the last year or so, and really turning back a lot of the terrorists. So I think that they do have that. I think that's the problem, quote unquote, from the side of you know, Saudis and Turkey and the NATO powers and all of them who want to get rid of Assad is that he still very much has the control over most of the country and increasingly gaining so control. So I think, again, the fact that they can't just exclude him completely from this is the stumbling block for that side of the conflict.
Has Assad been strengthened in the minds of the Syrian people? People actually live there, not invaders, not foreigners. People actually live there. Has Assad been strengthened among his own people by the threats of invasion and all of these foreigners trying to interfere in Syrian politics?
Well, I don't want to speak for the Syrian people, but from the people that I've read, the accounts that I've read, the people that I've talked to, the things that I've seen online, it is my impression that even the people who were not fans of Assad, and there were, I mean, clearly there were people who were not fans of him, many of them are now supporting the Assad government because it is the Syrian government and it is, you know, it's our decision. So I think there is a rallying to the flag that has happened, and it certainly has increased overall in terms of the support that people would have been willing to display for Assad and the government. I think it is an increase over these years. And again, it's not, I don't think it's that people love Assad per se. It's just that they want their own say over what's happening in their own country. Imagine that.
That's politically incorrect for sure. Let's assume that Assad was overthrown. Would the Syrian people accept whoever replaced him?
I suppose it depends. Overthrown how? Overthrown violently in some
I'd say violently.
Invasion? Yeah. If it was some sort of invasion scenario, I think there would be still a large resistance to whoever attempted to assert control over the country at that point. And it's unclear who would attempt to assert control. That's, I think, another big stumbling block of the side that wants Assad out, is that who on earth has the semblance of the sort of moral authority to take over the country, let alone the backing of most of the people. I mean, at this point, I think Assad is the only person who would enjoy the at least the tacit support of the majority of the country. Other than that, all you have is squabbling factions of terrorists who may or may not even be Syrians themselves. A lot of them, of course, imported from outside. So who is the leader that they're trying to replace him with? I mean, it just makes absolutely no sense from that perspective. If Assad's ouster is still the stumbling block, is the linchpin, is non-negotiable, I just don't see how this is going to end.
Is there any way for the United States, for example, to just sit back and say, look, this is more trouble than we can handle, we're backing out of this? Can they actually back out and leave this alone now, or are we ensnared in the sense that we walked into Vietnam and we sent a few special forces troops in and one thing led to another and we wound up in something enormous?
Right.
Are we trapped in this thing, or can we back out and say, wait, this is, you know, we don't have a solution, we're out of this place?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I guess it's the question of the possible versus the politically possible. I mean, imagine Obama came out tomorrow and said, you know what, we're kind of getting out of this mess. I mean, it would be, one would imagine that there would be a large section of the American electorate that would condemn, crucify the Democrats because, oh, you're walking out with your tails between your legs. And even from the, I think, a moral perspective, it is a question of the United States has actually helped foster the Islamic State now. So there is some element of responsibility there, and certainly they can't just walk away and, okay, well, now there's an Islamic State in the Middle East, oops. I mean, there has to be some resolution to that. So I don't think it's a – I mean, obviously we want the military aggression to stop, but it's a question of how do you end this and the Islamic State and extricate yourself. I mean, I don't really care about the sort of political egg that gets on people's faces. You shouldn't have got yourself into that situation in the first place. But it's not just a question of just walking away.
Yeah, I understand. If you could escape the problems by walking away, all right, we can imagine that they could cut and run and say, all right, we're out of here. This is too much. But if we stay, we don't run away, how are we going to come out ahead on this thing? Are we darned if we do and darned if we don't?
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, come out ahead for whom and in what way?
Well, all right. Just in the minds of the American people. We've expended a certain amount of resources and whatever. We jumped into this thing. We've got to come out with some kind of a victory, with something we can at least peace with honor. Is that what we're headed for?
Well, this is the real question, because what is America's interest in Syria? I mean, and why? I mean, to the average, I'm not talking to the political class, the inside the Beltway guys. I'm talking about regular average folks living in wherever, Oklahoma or Texas or Kentucky. What do they care about what is happening in Syria, except for the Islamic State that the American government has helped to foster into existence? And that is something that is now a global problem. But the answer certainly can't be more military aggression and trying to do jiggery pokery to get this guy ousted as leader of this country. I mean, that cannot be the solution. So I think there has to be military disengagement, but there has to be some, let's put it this way, stop supporting all of the groups that are supporting the Islamic State. I mean, that could be the first step towards this, because as has been openly acknowledged by the U.S. government now for some time, yeah, we keep sending them, you know, aid and weapons and all these things, and lo and behold, it keeps ending up with the Islamic State. So as a first order of business, stop doing that. And as a second order of business, finding out how to, I mean, ultimately get rid of the Islamic State would be the other side of this. But it cannot be supporting terrorists to kill other terrorists, because we all know how that story goes.
Yeah, to move on to NERP, negative interest rate policies. Here's a couple of sentences from Zero Hedge. It says, when NERP failed to resuscitate global growth and trade, the cash ban calls began. The thinking is simple. If you do away with physical banknotes, the effective lower bound is thereby eliminated. You can make rates as negative as you like, because the public has no recourse, as people aren't able to push back by eschewing their bank accounts and in the mattresses. Do you agree that NERP has inspired the calls for eliminating physical cash?
A bit of chicken and egg, because I think the calls for eliminating cash have been around for a while, but they certainly have increased in recent times, and I think they are linked. I think there is a sense in which these policies are linked, because NERP without taking away the people's ability to support cash is fairly useless as a monetary tool, like what they're trying to use it for, as another extension of their ability to manipulate monetary policy. Without being able to stop the hoarding of cash, NERP doesn't have the effect that that they want it to have. So the two go hand in hand. I think they are absolutely linked. And, oh, by the way, it also comes with all the kind of police state surveillance controls that the government always wants. So, hey, bonus.
I saw a report this last week where Southern Florida people are taking, it was either Colombian or maybe Venezuelan, but I think it was Colombian banknotes as payment for, you know, in bait shops or wherever. And the reason that's significant to me is, all right, the government bans $100 bills and $20 bills and so on. We're out of American cash. What's going to prevent an influx of some other currency from entering the United States? We've used the dollar all over the world as primary currency. You can use it in New Delhi and, in Mexico and any place you want to use it. You could get away with using the dollar. All right, ban the dollar. What's going to stop some other currency from being used? Can they really get away from a physical currency?
No, ultimately no, because even if they got rid of all fiat paper currencies on the planet, people would just trade in other things like precious metals or Bitcoin or any other number of things that could become currency, because what people fundamentally want to do is trade with their neighbors and have a medium of exchange for doing so. It isn't really a complicated thing, but it's been made into this incredibly complicated system of control that's engineered by a central bank and all of these rules and regulations and laws. But the space where the black market opens when that becomes untenable, or when they just try to outlaw it altogether. So ultimately, yes, I think you're right. I don't think they can completely get rid of it. I think that's why there's such a push to make the cashless society something that people want. It's so convenient. It's so easy. You know, you just scan your card and you're done and you're out. You don't have to fiddle with all this paper or whatever. They want people to want the cashless society so that they don't think about trying to circumvent it.
I was talking to Wendy Wilson. We interviewed her earlier today on medical issues. And she said, according to some studies, pharmaceuticals have discovered that people are going to hospitals or doctors, and 60% of them aren't taking the meds that the doctors are prescribing because they are worried about the safety of those meds. 60%. This is evidence to me that the people and the internet is helping people to understand things where the doctor is no longer a little tin god. And likewise, people that are running the Federal Reserve are no longer little tin gods. And people are, they actually are starting to think for themselves and say, I don't want this. Can we impose these currency controls and get rid of the $100 bills and the rest of that when 60% of the people aren't willing to take their meds? And presumably these are the same 60% are going to say, look, I want some cash, because it may not be quite as convenient as plastic or whatever they intend to use in the cashless society. But on the other hand, there's only two parties involved. I go buy something. This guy over here, John, he's got his pickup truck. I want to buy the pickup truck. I don't need a third-party government intervening in this transaction. I'll give him the money. He gives me the truck. I don't know if there's a question there or not.
Well, but I get what you're going at, and let's put a bow on the whole conversation then, because I think this ties back to what we were talking about earlier, where it's difficult to even imagine the kind of lifestyle people were living 100, 200, 300 years ago, where, you know, the world you grew up in would be the same in your childhood and your old mm-hmm. age. It would be the same society your grandparents grew up in. That doesn't exist anymore. And in the same way, I think we're seeing this kind of what the internet and the free flow of information has enabled is a true questioning of so many of the fundamental paradigms by which political control has been wielded over the masses. And we're starting to see the dislocation in things like people rejecting medicines that otherwise you would assume 50 years ago you wouldn't have had that type of rejection.
You wouldn't have dared. The doctor said take it. The doctor. We've got to do what the doctor says.
Exactly.
Now.
Or Trump and Sanders, you know, I mean, those are reflections of the same phenomenon. Or things like Bitcoin, where people want to try to find a way outside of the banking system, and that's going to increase. And the possibilities for doing that increase as the technology increases as well. The only question to my mind is, ultimately, again, this comes back to consciousness. It comes back to the way that people understand what is happening or just go along with what is happening. If people can be made to desire the cashless society, then they won't think to try to get around it. But if they're placed into a corner where, you know, you either starve or you trade with your neighbor in some contraband substance, they're going to trade with their neighbor in a contraband substance. So there is a dislocation that's happening right now. And I see it as a revolutionary moment. I mean, again, think back to the early 20th century and the kind of incredible revolutionary changes that were happening politically and geopolitically and socially and economically at that time. And so for people who have grown up in, you know, the late 20th century, who haven't seen those types of changes, those kind of crazy revolutionary changes happening quite so much, you know, I mean, we may not be used to that, but I think we are approaching that type of era again, and we're going to see some huge changes in the coming years.
It'll be interesting. We live in interesting times. The old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. Well, we do. James, thank you for being on the program. Hope to talk to you again next week. In the meantime, folks, hope you'll tune in. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank the producer, and James Corbett. All right.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me.